Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. We do have a number of things on the agenda. I have, as you can see at the dais, three councils, and so what we're going to do is I'm going to batch them together so I can move them out so they can do other work that they need to do. So what we're going to do is we're going to be jumping around on the agenda, but let me just kind of give you a roadmap of where I think we will be going and when we're going to get there. We're going to start off with the work sessions of 3253A, as well as followed up by 2962A. Those two are ones that Mike Schmidt has. I want to go ahead and let him out, and then we're going to come back. We'll have a public hearing on House Bill 2596A, which Bill Taylor's covering. We'll also do a work session on House Bill 2710. The remainder is under Anna, and so we'll pick those up at the end. So with that, let's go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 3253A. Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3253A requires persons convicted of crimes in a court of the United States that required sex offender registration to register in Oregon, even if the crime they were convicted of does not require registration in Oregon, pertains to federal convictions, applies only to crimes committed after the passage of this act. There is an amendment before the committee, is the A6 amendment. This amendment was requested by Department of Justice in conjunction with OSP, the state police, which essentially makes clear that even if the crime in a different jurisdiction would not have been a sex crime in Oregon, the person will carry the registration requirements from the state of origin in order to not incentivize people moving to Oregon to get out of requirements that may have existed in their jurisdiction.
All right. Senator Dingfelder?
So, Mr. Chair, you want adoption of the Dash A6? I move the adoption of Dash A6 amendments into House Bill 3253.
Senator Dingfelder moves the A6 into House Bill 3253A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3253A as amended with the Dash A6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dingfelder now moves House Bill 3253A as amended by the A6 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Roebling, will you be the carrier on this
one? I will.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3253A. We'll now open up a work session on House Bill 2962A. Mike?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2962A would change the current standard applied by courts in speedy trial to incorporate the constitutional standard. There is an amendment on this which would replace the bill, which puts a sunset on the current statutory trial provision that exists today, so that provision would expire April 1st, 2014. So essentially, status quo would be maintained until April 1st, 2014, at which time statutory speedy trial would cease to exist.
And what is the number on the amendment?
That is the A4.
A4s. All right, so what I want to do is put on the record, we had a discussion with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association's representatives yesterday regarding this bill. I have looked at this. This is one of those issues that it seems to me that we do, in fact, need to be making modifications to the statute, but because of the time limitations, that weren't able to actually put together an amendment. So in working with Gail Meyer, we agreed that what we would do is the sunset, as Mike has said. This sunset will basically maintain the status quo as we have it today under current law, and then that statute will in fact sunset on April 1 of next year. That will allow us in February to come back and actually make the modifications. It will also allow us as a committee during the interim to have a work group process that will bring back what they believe is appropriate. This will be a work group that will include not only the criminal defense lawyers, but I hope to have the Oregon District Attorneys Association, Department of Justice, and I believe there may be one other group that would be potentially part of this, which would be the State Bar had, I think, offered to kind of ushered this one through, so then they will probably bring something back to us to consider during our interim meetings. So I wanted to put that all on the record so everyone knows where we're heading with this. Any questions, Senator Robelin?
Yeah, is this something the Law Commission would be interested in?
This might be something the Law Commission may be interested in. We could ask them as well. That's a good thought. The one thing I will say, as being one of the people on the commission, it does take a lot of time for that process to work, and this may be one that we may not want to ask them to spend their valuable time on this. So, but I think it's a good point, and we will look at that as a possibility, and knowing what our time frames will be. Any other discussions? Any other comments? So with that, the chair will move the A4s into House Bill 2962A.
Yeah, first. So, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the dash A4s into House Bill 2962.
That's
Senator, Senator Dingfelder seconds the chair's motion.
I'm on autopilot.
That's quite all right. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I'm sorry, counsel was distracting me with that script.
It's a plot.
Yes.
All right, Senator Dingfelder.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, because the fiscal and the revenue impact statements are not complete, we need a motion for that. So I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking final action on House Bill 2962 as amended with the dash A4s without the fiscal or revenue impact statement.
All right, Senator Dingfelder moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking final action on House Bill 2962A as amended by the A4s without having the fiscal and or revenue fiscal impact statements. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Okay, Senator Dingfelder. Chair, I move House Bill 2962A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Dingfelder now moves House Bill 2962A as amended by the A4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Dingfelder, will you carry this one? Or do you want the chair?
I was going to say the chair might want
to explain
what the plan is for this one.
That will be fine. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2962A. And we're now going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2596A. And before, Bill, you do this, Mike, I want to thank you for your work. I'm not sure if we're going to have you back before the committee, but it's been a pleasure having you as on loan for the session. And we hope to be able to have cheers later. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, committee.
Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2596 comes to you from the House Interim Committee of the Judiciary. It creates a cause of action for a private entity that contracts with the State Forestry Department to perform forest practices for actual damages plus attorney's fees against a person while on state forest lands or an access road in state forest lands intentionally obstructs or impairs the private entity in the performance of the forest practices. So, Chair, members of the committee, you have the A4 amendments in front of you, which change the statute of limitations to bring an action from 6 years to 2 years. 2 years is the normal statute of limitations for a tort action. I think what happened is here when it was drafted, and I didn't catch this, because we're talking about a contract between a private party in the state forest lands, someone assumed it would be the statute of limitations for contract, which is 6 years. When, in fact, the action that would be brought here would be a tort action for interference, for example, chaining to offense. So that's the reason for that. As chairman of the committee, the other thing is we do use the language in the bill that talks about attempt. And attempt, the person intentionally engages in conduct which constitutes a substantial step towards commission of, in this case, a crime. But this would be a step to interfere, a substantial step. This doesn't mean you go out and say, you know, we should demonstrate. It means that you're in the process of putting the chain around the gate. So that's basically to clarify that issue, Mr. Chairman of the committee.
All right. Thank you. I have two individuals that have signed up to give testimony, and Bill, do we know if Representative Krieger was planning on...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I spoke to him just briefly this morning, and he's, I think he's tied up in another committee. He's tied up in another committee. He will not be here.
Actually chained to the chair.
But he's very much in favor of the bill. He has chained to...
Okay, fine. So let's go ahead. I have Ben Jones and Jason Gonzalez, if you two would like to come forward. While they're coming forward, is there anyone else who did not get a chance to sign up on the registry who would like to give testimony on House Bill 2596A?
Yes.
Kevin? Okay, thank you. And Kevin, if you'd like to come on up on the third chair. And what I'm going to do, gentlemen, I'm going to let Kevin Campbell go first, and then we'll have your testimony.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Oregon Loggers, and I know that Representative Krieger wanted to be here. It could not at the last minute. Jim Geisinger, the Executive Vice President of Associated Oregon Loggers, also wanted to be here this morning and is out of town, was unable to be here, so you're stuck with me. My testimony will be very brief. As you know, there were two bills that dealt with the whole issue of forest hindering. One handled the issue from a criminal perspective, the other from a civil remedy perspective, and so today's bill deals with the civil side. The Associated Oregon Loggers are, they're contract loggers. There are almost 1,000 companies in the Associated Oregon Loggers network, and as you can imagine, they are very small, often family businesses, most of them 10 employees and under. They don't own the land that they're logging. They operate under contract, and when forest protest hinders their work, it is a huge impact on their livelihood. So this particular bill is designed to give them a remedy, and that is really the purpose for the bill and the reason the Associated Oregon Loggers supports it today. I appreciate the committee's willingness to consider this measure, and I appreciate the efforts to amend it in order to make sure that it falls in line with statute of limitations provisions of other law. And so with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I hope you can support the bill today. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Ben, Jason, who would like to go first? And whoever would like to, if you just make sure you put your name on the record. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Jason Gonzalez. I'm here in opposition to this bill today. I'm going to have to adapt my statements a little as I go along. I was not aware of the amendment on limitations, statute of limitations. That was one of the issues that we were raising with this bill. I apologize if I have kind of a stalling point there while I work around that.
That's okay.
Additionally, to that issue, there was a number. I sent in some comments, and we worked on trying to call members of this committee to notify them of some of the numerous issues we had with this bill. And I think I want to make clear that I feel like if I feel like this was a fair bill that was just meant to give the timber industry a opportunity to get their fair day in court, I think that I would have a much harder time arguing against it. While I would still feel like it was an attempt to chill protest activity in an unfair way, I would understand the committee and the House's motivations in putting it forward, but I don't think that's the case. I think that this bill creates some very special circumstances and special situations for the timber industry that I don't quite understand, and I feel are more of an intimidation tactic than anything else. The first of those being, in discussing this bill with attorneys, we've had a hard time understanding why it is that this bill doesn't have a prevailing party statute and instead allows the timber industry to sue us, fail, and still and we can't collect attorney's fees from them. I have a hard time understanding why it is that the bill specifically allows them, in the event of winning the case, to collect attorney's fees from us, but does not allow the opposite situation to occur, especially considering the fact that we're not talking about the situation here of giant businesses suing each other. We are very specifically talking about the situation here of very large corporations suing individual unfunded protesters for very simple activities. I heard counsel explain the fact that they feel that that we're talking here about a situation of somebody specifically chaining themselves to a gate, but I don't feel like that's what the language of the bill actually accomplishes, and I don't believe that that's the way that it would be used. I think simple actions such as standing in a road or being in an area in an attempt to hinder an operation are actually the situations that we would be dealing with here, and that the fact that frivolous lawsuits would not give the opportunity for a defendant to claim reasonable attorney's fees is ridiculous and worthy of a no vote. Another big concern of mine is the fact that in reading the wording of this bill and discussing with attorneys, I do not see why there is not the opportunity for the following situation to occur. One of the reasons that people protest these sales is because they are often considered by us to be illegal sales that under proper review would not have moved forward in the first place. This has been clearly demonstrated in the Elliott, Tillamook, and Clatsop State Forests that this bill really specifically involves. I think part of the reason these bills came forward was the frustration from the timber industry that the fact that protesters were able to challenge those logging operations, bring public attention to them, and then more or less have lost the ability to log in those forests due to the fact that they were not logging under the proper guidance of the law, and therefore a court stopped their sale. So my concern is that the following situation could occur, that a protesting group would be able to block a logging operation while the typical kind of process continued of another organization suing to stop that sale, a court deciding that the sale was actually invalid in the first place and canceling it, and the people protesting being held liable for the cost of the sale because they lost it as damages. I understand that the House and the Judiciary Committee obviously wouldn't have intended for that to be the way things have played out. I have a hard time believing that the formers of the bill didn't see that as a possibility, and in discussing it with a few attorneys, have a hard time believing that that situation couldn't occur. To me, that's a terrifying situation. We're talking about somebody being possibly liable for potentially millions of dollars in damage for stopping something that a judge found to be illegal. Additionally, we call these suits oftentimes, in activism, we call the suits slap suits when industry is using these civil litigation situations to kind of intimidate and stop people from protesting their activity. And we actually have seen nationwide a trend of states, instead of codifying these types of suits into their codes, actually trying to prevent them from happening in the first place. Specifically, the fact that 2 years ago, the state of Texas, even, for example, banned this type of situation. If a state as industry-friendly as Texas can see the absurdity of using of these big companies being able to use their teams of lawyers to intimidate individuals from protest activity that is really intended to be in the interest of the people, a state like Oregon can. And finally, I understand that there's a lot of pressure from Representative Krieger on members of this committee to vote for this bill, and I understand that there's a lot of politics involved. But I think that I work with a number of groups here, and everybody here is aware that a number of very large environmental groups and liberal groups have come out in opposition to this bill, as well as its partner bill, which we are very thankful failed to kind of make it through here. But I feel like environmentalists and people that are looking out for public interest in this state are really sick of Oregon politicians throwing us under the bus for short-term political gains. And I want to encourage the members of this committee, and I will continue to encourage further members of the Senate, to recognize the fact that this isn't just some simple bill. It's been explained thoroughly that there's nothing preventing these industries from currently trying to sue protesters. What this bill does is give them kind of special rules. It kind of gives them a special situation. It takes away their risk, so they have no inherent financial risk in bringing physical frivolous lawsuits or lawsuits that turn out to have not much standing. It actually encourages them to do so because that would cost us money and not them. They know that we're not funded. Y'all know that we're not funded. We really are just individuals who are out fighting this. We have organizations that we work with. We all struggle to get by day because most of our time is committed to this. If the prevailing part of the statute is not a part of this. It's just, to me, I see it as a possibility for an intimidation tactic. And I feel like we're really sick, and environmentalists in Oregon as a whole are really sick of seeing things that are important to them being thrown under the bus by Oregon politicians because they're looking to make short-term political gains in other arenas. And I think that we are very likely to see that happening here. And I just want to encourage folks to avoid going down that route. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. Is this being recorded? My name is Ben Jones. I work with Cascadia Forest Defenders. I'm here to speak in opposition of this bill today. The partner of this bill, HB 2595, more succinctly stated it, but this is a bill directly targeting my organization, Cascadia Forest Defenders, and other groups that work to preserve biodiversity in this bioregion. And
I just like want to very strongly emphasize to elected officials that we are members of the community. I work for contractors for the Forest Service. So do many of us. We have jobs in the industry. We come, we're families, you know, we have kids, we work. We are not eco-terrorists, as was initially proposed and was leveled at us by the proposer of this bill. And that's something I really strongly want to emphasize to the people here, that that's just a label that gets thrown around when these are the most important things to us, protection of our biodiversity. It's interesting to me that in a time of declining timber prices, it almost just seems like this is another attempt to make money, but this time out of an attempt to sue activists. And as my colleague has just mentioned, we don't really have that much money. So it's a far way of codifying a simpler method of suing activists who are engaging in political protests. I don't really see that as a viable tactic for the timber industry to solve systemic issues of poor forestry practices for the last 100 years. This is not going to solve the problem of the cut. This is not going to solve the problem of jobs. This is just not what this bill is about. Some of the amendments, like for instance the attempting to hinder, the language of that Mr. Taylor emphasized of attempting to hinder was very worrisome. I'm very glad that was clarified a little bit, because that appeared to me attempting to hinder is completely arbitrary. I also sort of want to emphasize the fact that not being able to have, that this bill seems to target also the lawyers who are sympathetic, and that is of, like, of how not being able to have restitution for, what's the term exactly, not being able to have our lawyers get benefits, however that's codified in the law, I believe you know what I'm talking about. Seems to me just a very clear attack at people who are working in this type of work. It doesn't really seem to be a balanced and fair thing. We're all lawyers. Like, that seems very clear to me. I want to very strongly stress my organization and most conservation organizations' opposition to this bill. It seems to me just a very clear prosecution of citizens for the benefit of private industry in a time where more than ever people are looking for accountability from their corporations, and even stronger from their elected officials. So drop this bill. Please criminalize the real criminals, which are the ones who are breaking the laws that we're protesting in the first place. In that way, we wouldn't have to be here anyways. There are more fundamental issues than what protesters are doing. Maybe why are they protesting? I'd rather the committee spend their time worrying about why citizens are angry rather than what the industry wants to do to silence dissent. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Comments? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2596A? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We're going to continue on the agenda. We'll come back to this one. So at this point, we're going to drop down for a work session on House Bill 2710. Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2710 comes to you from Representative Huffman, who was in the hearing room just a little while ago. You have the Dash 5 amendments in front of you, which came out yesterday. This is a product of a work group consisting of law enforcement, the ACLU, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Oregon Aviation Board, Senator Cruz, yourself, and I have the Dash 5 amendments in front of me. And if I could, with your indulgence, I'll go through them in more detail than we normally do. Chair, members of the committee, Section 1 defines drone as an unmanned flying machine. Drone does not include a model aircraft. So if you are a model aircraft as defined by Federal Aviation Modernization Reform Act of 2012, you are not subject to this act. Section 2, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, except as otherwise provided in Section 2 to 7 of this Act, a law enforcement agency may not operate a drone. So we start off with the premise, unless specifically allowed by statute, a law enforcement agency cannot operate a drone. And then it goes on to state that any information acquired in violation of this cannot be used in court, cannot be used in administrative proceeding. Chairman of the committee, then in Section 3, a law enforcement agency may operate a drone, acquire information to the operation of the drone, or disclose information if a warrant is issued authorizing the use of the drone. Law enforcement agency has probable cause to believe that a crime is being committed at the time the drone is used, and exigent circumstance exists that makes it unreasonable for law enforcement agency to obtain a drone. So what you have is a statutory blanket prohibition, unless the legislature allows,
And then within those allowances, you're required to have a warrant unless exigent circumstances exist. For example, you have a warrant on me, and I'm with someone else, and that other person in your following, tracking me, and I commit a crime with that other person. That would allow law enforcement to use that information obtained by the drone on that other person as well as me. Going down through Section 4, law enforcement agents may operate a drone for the purposes of acquiring information about an individual or about individual's property if the individual has given written consent. Section 5, law enforcement may operate a drone, acquire information through the operation of this drone for the purposes of search and rescue. That's an exception, so they can do it for search and rescue. They can do it in the Section sub 2 of 5 for the may operate a drone or disclose information to the operation of drone for the purpose of assisting an individual in an emergency. And then it has qualifiers there under A and B. Law enforcement agency reasonably believes there is an imminent threat of life or safety, and not more than 48 hours after the emergency operation begins, files a sworn statement with the circuit court describing the nature of the emergency. 3, a law enforcement agency may operate a drone or disclose information during a state of emergency that is declared by the governor if, A and B, the drone is used only for the purposes of preserving public safety and the drone is operated only in a geographical area. Section 6, a law enforcement agency may operate a drone for the purposes of reconstruction of a specific crime scene or physical assessment relating to a specific criminal investigation. The period of law enforcement may operate the drone is not to exceed 5 days. Section 7, a law enforcement agency may operate a drone for the purposes of training if in the use of drones and acquisition of information through the operation of a drone. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are the facts and circumstances under which a law enforcement agency may use a drone. Registration of drones used by public bodies. A public body may not operate in the airspace over this state without registering the drone with the Oregon Department of Aviation. Now, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as it relates to public airways, the state of Oregon cannot regulate private use of drones. However, we can regulate what public bodies do because they are subject to the state jurisdiction. The Oregon Department of Aviation may impose a civil penalty of up to $10,000 against a public body who violates this section. More importantly, evidence obtained by the public body for the use of the drone in violation of this section is not admissible in any judicial administrative proceeding. The Department of Aviation will establish a registry. The public bodies will have to file that, and they will have to summarize yearly statements of how often they're using the drone and for what purposes. So, Chair, remember, the registration provision does not go into effect until January 1, 2016. First off, it's very difficult to get a certificate from the Federal Aviation Administration. I think only Oregon State has one in this state. So we're delaying that for many reasons. First off, it will give the Aviation Board a chance to get ready for it. And they are also required, the Aviation Board may adopt rules, but in another provision, they are required to report back to the legislature during the interim concerning what the Federal Aviation Board is doing and also whether drones should be registered in the state to the same extent that airplanes are.
Mr. Chair, if I could. Bill, I mean, basically, until we close the circle with FAA, we really don't know where we're going with this anyway.
Chair, members of the committee, I hate to use a pun, but there's a lot up in the air.
Yeah. Yes.
I couldn't resist it. Prohibition of the use of weaponized drones. We do not allow public bodies to operate drones that are capable of carrying a firearm. Now, let me say at this time, we exempt the law enforcement, the armed services of the United States, which also includes the Oregon National Guard. Because you may know that particularly in eastern Oregon, the Navy for years maintains a firing range over there for airplanes, and drones are most likely being tested over there.
Yep.
Use of information, I'm going over to page 5, use of information acquired by public bodies from drones. Any image or information that is acquired by a public body for use of drone that is not approved by the Federal Aviation Administration is not admissible in any proceeding.
So if you are a public body and you do get certified by the FAA, then at some point in the future you could use that information, but you can't now. Crimes involving drones. A person commits a Class A felony if the person possesses or controls a drone and intentionally causes the drone to fire a bullet or other projectile at an aircraft while the aircraft is in the air, directs a laser at the aircraft while the aircraft is in the air, crashes into aircraft while the aircraft is in the air. Secondly, a person who intentionally interferes with or gains unauthorized control of a drone licensed by the FAA, so that's a UAV, that's a more sophisticated machine than, say, your hobby aircraft, are operated by the Armed Services of the United States, commits a Class C felony. Mr. Chairman of the Committee, page 6 at the bottom, civil remedies. In addition to any of the remedies allowed by law, a person who intentionally interferes or gains control of a drone licensed by the FAA or the federal government is liable to the owner of the drone in an amount not less than $5,000. The court shall award reasonable attorney's fees to the prevailing plaintiff in an action under this section. So, Chair, members of the committee, University of Texas in an experiment has already hacked into a drone and has caused a UAV to land. There is significant evidence that the Iran may have done the same thing to one of our drones, and that's how they got it. Section 15, except as provided in subsection 2 of the section, the person who owns or lawfully occupies real estate in this state may bring an action against any person or public body that operates a drone that is flown at a height of less than 400 feet over the property. And let me tell you the significance about 400 feet. There is an Oregon Supreme Court case in the situation the police had a helicopter above someone's property where they discovered a marijuana grow. It went to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals, using the old ancient common law doctrine, stated that the property owner owns to the heavens, therefore it was a trespass, therefore the police did not have probable cause to get a search warrant to go on the property. The Oregon Supreme Court said if we followed that logic, we wouldn't have airplane flight in this country. The U.S. Supreme Court had suddenly said the same thing and said that since the helicopter was above 400 feet, there was no trespass, therefore they had probable cause. The inference to be drawn from that is if you were below 400 feet, the property owner has a proprietary interest in that property, and that it would constitute a common law trespass to be within that space. This is different. The challenges you face here is if I have my doorbell and I don't have a sign to say no trespassing, you assume you have a right to be there. If I put a sign up by my front door saying no trespassing, you're on notice that I don't want you there. That's difficult to do above the ground. So what we have done here is the owner of the property will give notice to the person who was flying the drone that they are repeatedly, you've been over my property and I would appreciate it if you stop it. Now, I doubt they're going to be able to determine without sophisticated equipment whether they're 399 feet or 401 feet. My assumption is this will arise when the drone is, you know, 2 feet above your roof or outside your window. So when that happens and they bring notice and then they have to go to court, they get attorney's fees, okay? The plaintiff gets attorney's fees. But what we have done is we have tied this into the small claims action. So what would happen is the plaintiff would have to give notice to the trespasser that we are seeking in the small claims, we are seeking attorney's fees. And they're assuming they're suing for under $10,000, which most likely they're going to be. And most likely what they're wanting to do is just have them stop doing it. Then they would give notice they're going to seek attorney's fees, and then the party would have an option to stop or to make a counteroffer, which may negate the attorney's fees anyways. Let me go on, if I may. The Attorney General, on behalf of the State of Oregon, may bring an action or claim for relief alleging nuisance or trespass on behalf of the state. Applicably, the Armed Forces Section 16, as I mentioned earlier, does not apply to the Armed Forces of the United States. Section 17, this was something that was added yesterday and suggested, we expressly the state expressly preempts local government from regulating this area. It's an activity that will be in this state statewide, and what you probably do not want is a patchwork of regulation, especially when it's 400 feet up in the air and you're not sure whether you're in one city or one county or whatever. Report to the legislature, the Oregon Department, Section 18, the Oregon Department of Aviation shall report to the Joint Committee of the Legislative Assembly relating to the judiciary or the other appropriate committee on the status of federal regulations and whether unmanned aerial vehicles operated by private parties should be registered in Oregon in a manner similar to that required for other aircraft. Chair, members of the committee, the final section, Section 20, emergency clause.
Thank you. Senator Cruz, comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, first I want to thank everybody for their work on this. I think we have, Mr. Chair, what I would consider a good start. Our conversations have been basically this may be an issue we'll be dealing with for the rest of our lives, 1 year at a time. But this does give us a starting point there. And I would also point out, other than what was actually stated in the bill, there are other issues that we will probably be considering going into 14. For example, should there be any restrictions on what state agencies can do, not only with drones, but with information? At this point in time, I think it's premature for us to go there, but it's discussions we need to have in the future. And as Mr. Taylor has said repeatedly, every day he finds something new. And he has become kind of the repository of drone information in this building, whether he wanted to be or not. It's happened to you, Bill. So, and Ms. Chair, I appreciate your commitment to carrying forward with looking at these multitude of issues in the interim, and I'm sure we'll see another bill in 14 that will further refine what we're starting today.
All right, thank you. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, I just want to make it clear that I really appreciate getting the model airplane enthusiasts out. We have a lot of those groups that have active activities going around our communities, and I think they do it in appropriate ways, and I'm excited that that's not being covered by this, and they're really given that exclusion. I also appreciate the fact that we are really looking mostly at ourselves and law enforcement and restricting their use until we figure this out more. I think you've done a good job of crafting those things that way and still allow a burgeoning industry. I mean, I think agriculture and others are going to take advantage of this for the years to come, and I think it's a good thing. So.
Well, thank you. Senator Dingfelder?
Thank you. And I wanted to echo some of the comments Senator Roblin said about careful deliberations on this. Appreciate your work on that. One question I had to follow up on what Mr. Taylor said. I heard you mention OSU, Oregon State University. Can you talk a little bit about how this would affect them? They're a public body. I heard you say that they're already, are they already registered with already have a permit? I'm assuming that they're, you know, part of, I just want to make sure that we've checked with them that this doesn't hinder their ability to do research, thinking about for agricultural situations.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it should not hinder them. Public bodies that do not have UAV licenses, first off, legally they can't operate. Oregon State can, if they have the license, legally operate. And we basically said that in that section that we, unless you're authorized by the FAA, you can't use the information. Since they're authorized, they can use it. But we're talking about information that would come into a court or administrative proceeding. So it could under that circumstances, but it still would allow them to operate because, you know, if the prohibition is when the information comes into the agency, okay, or to judicial administrative proceedings, and that's when you don't have a license. So let's say you have someone, a third party, who does not have a licensed UAV, and that's an area that at some point we're going to have to deal with, does not meet the federal definition of a hobby craft, is not licensed, obtains information, sends it to the agency. The way I read the provision, that couldn't be used. But if it came in from Oregon State that is authorized, it could be used. But I believe that they are using that purely for their own educational purposes.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Cruz?
Pull me down.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
No.
I think at this point, based on what we have, we need to adopt the A5. We don't have the paperwork, if I'm correct, so we do need to suspend the rules.
Okay. All right, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the dash five amendments into House Bill 2710.
All right, before we can take action on that, I'm going to go ahead and let Senator Cruz move.
Mr. Chair, we can adopt the amendment, and then we have to suspend the rules.
All right, fine. Yeah, that's correct. All right, so we have a motion to adopt the A5s into House Bill 2710. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of moving House Bill 2710 as amended by the A5 amendment to the Senate floor without the fiscal or revenue statements.
All right, Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking final action on House Bill 2710 as amended by the A5s without the fiscal and revenue impact statements. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2710 as amended with the dash fives to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Dingfelder moves House Bill 2710 as amended by the A5s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, if you'll be the carrier, I'm going to have you open and I may close depending
on
what
that would be fine.
That would be fine. So with that, we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2710, and we're going to go back up and do our public hearing on House Bill 2449, and open up the public hearing on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2449 adds Assistant Attorneys General to the list of public employees prohibited from striking or recognizing a picket line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I have a number of individuals who want to give testimony on this bill, so I'm going to ask the proponents to come forward, and it looks like it's Mark Abrams, Judith Anderson, Simon Wheatland.
Simone White.
Simone White, please. Mm-hmm.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Mark Abrams. I am treasurer of AFSCME Council 75, and more importantly today, I am here as president of Local 1085, the Oregon Association of Justice Attorneys, representing 235 lawyers who work for you and the citizens of Oregon every day, proudly. In the audience, we also have several other members of our union, also attorneys general who work for the public good. We're here today in support of House Bill 2449, which has already passed the House, I believe by a vote of 38 to 19, that would take attorneys general and put them along with other workers in state government who are largely involved in public safety into the category of being strike barred in exchange for binding arbitration. This is a logical step to take because, although you may not recognize it, roughly, by my count, 70% of our members spend some, much, or all of their time involved in public safety, direct prosecution of criminals, defense of appeals from those criminals, protection of children who are being abused, licensure issues such as keeping people safe from improper practitioners of phony medicine or teachers who prey on children. We are largely involved in the needs of the people of Oregon in that regard. As a result, we are appropriate for this. The reason we seek this is to restore a balance that was intended by this legislature when it passed the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, a balance that is out of whack for our members, because while we are allowed technically to strike, and indeed there is a bar opinion that says we can strike as unionized attorneys, as a practical matter, it's simply not possible. I can tell you as a litigator, I do things that if we were out on strike, we would be just annihilating deadlines, getting into trouble with courts, getting sanctioned. You cannot replace us. Our managers were at a 10 or 11 to 1 ratio. They have their own caseloads. They cannot take it on, nor can you credibly find replacement lawyers out there, even if you would want to. They know nothing about tort claim limits. They know nothing about sovereign immunity. And frankly, if their clients are in the private sector, they know nothing about constitutional law, which is one of the great aspects of the kinds of practice we do in the litigation and appeals areas. Now, as a result, a strike is not only not feasible, we don't want to strike. We don't want to have to put ourselves in a situation where we don't live up to our obligations to the citizens of Oregon, which we held very closely and very important and very dearly for ourselves. So this is the reason that the chair himself sponsored the predecessor bill 2 years ago that passed the Senate, didn't get a vote in the House, and why we're back again hoping to complete this. We are not replaceable. You shouldn't want us in this position. In the House, the Department of Justice somewhat amazingly testified that we were fungible, and we respectfully suggest we are not, nor should we be. Public safety, as I said, is our main area. Ms. Anderson and Ms. Wayan will give you some examples in a minute. I just want to add one more point here, which is I know some of you have been told that this may be attainable for us through collective bargaining. Frankly, that is not true. Collective bargaining for the Oregon Association of Justice Attorneys has been ongoing since we presented our proposals in December. We have been meeting with management since January. We're way past the cutoff for new proposals. Management in all that time, and I see Ms. Bennett from DOJ and Mr. Cowan from DAS here, who are on management's bargaining committee, and they are honorable people. I expect they will confirm what I tell you. Management has not put a binding arbitration proposal on the table in 5 months. Management has rejected the binding arbitration proposal that the union put on the table. Now, management put on the table a non-binding arbitration proposal that would say, if you don't like what the arbitrator says, well, that's nice. We don't have to pay attention to it. That's not the same. It doesn't create the rebalancing intended by PECBA. So accordingly, Chair, Senators, we ask for your support for 2449 to move to the Senate floor. And with that, I will let my colleagues tell you a little more about the work we do and why it is indeed public safety related.
Chair Prezansky, members of the committee, my name is Judith Anderson, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the General Counsel section. I work in a section that deals with the professional licensing agencies in the state of Oregon, and in that capacity, we all are daily confronted with situations where we're representing our client to make sure that practitioners who have violated standards of care and placed people in danger are removed, their licenses are removed so that they won't be out there in putting a threat of harm with people. One of my clients is the Teacher Standards Practice Commission. We unfortunately work with teachers who prey on children. The sexual misconduct happens occasionally. You'll read about the big cases in the paper, but there are other cases that you probably wouldn't read about in the paper that we deal with. And we feel like we need this continuity of service. We don't want to be taken out of service when these cases are ongoing that we become very familiar with, working with the commission, working with the investigators, to make sure that we can present in our administrative hearing a case that will persuade the administrative law judge that this person should have their license revoked. And in some cases, we're able to persuade, working through the educator's attorney, that it's best for everybody that they give up their license or they agree to a revocation. You see cases where sexual misconduct puts kids at risk. And in the last 3.5 years, I've counted over 50 cases where teachers were revoked for sexual misconduct. These are some of the important type of work that we do, and we really feel that that's part of public safety. And so we ask for your support of this bill.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Simone Wyand, Chair Prezansky, and members of the committee. I am a former senior deputy district attorney and a current assistant attorney general for the Department of Justice in the Child Advocacy Section. I work along with over 40 other attorneys, many of which are former deputy district attorneys in the Child Advocacy Section in all 36 counties and every day of the week to primarily do termination of parental rights trials for abused and neglected children. But that's not what this bill is about. And it's not about the Attorney General, who we all have a tremendous amount of respect for and I will say are very, very proud to work for. This bill, to many of us, is about the thousands of children that are Oregon's foster care system. This bill is about the children that come to our schools every single day with burns and bruises on their bodies because their parents use them as punching bags and ashtrays. They're about the little girls in this state that are in our system because their mother's boyfriends have repeatedly raped and sexually abused them because mom thinks that's okay because that's how men show their love. This is about the children waiting in our system for adoption and the termination of their abusive parents' rights because they've been waiting for years for mom and dad to choose feeding them over feeding their drug habit. These cases do not come to the AG's office because it's reunification time. They come because these kids have already waited a minimum of 12 to 24 months to get to us so that we can go in on the behalf of this state and the Department of Human Services and free them for adoption. We go in because we have to pick up that ball. We have to look at those files and we have to say to our law enforcement partners, you sometimes risked your lives to get these children out of these homes. And we cannot, because we go on strike, let these children go home. Because it takes over a year at times, 6 months minimum, but over a year many times to get these cases in the docket. If the attorneys in my section were to walk, it would be a great public safety disaster. I don't know how we would look at these children and say, I'm sorry, you've been waiting a year, but I have to strike, and now you have to wait another until the court dockets open up. These kids do not deserve to have labor disputes be a part of their life. I am a proud union member, but I am here to tell you, we should not be allowed to strike. I think it is in the interest of public safety, is a necessity. And as a former deputy district attorney who specialized in child abuse, homicide, prosecution, we were not allowed to strike. One other member that was going to be here to testify is Assistant Attorney General Dan Wendell. He came before the committee years ago when the legislature made deputy district attorneys part of the public safety bill and strike prohibited. He gave testimony there, and he is doing the same work as an assistant attorney general over in our criminal justice section. He's not here today because, again, he is a vital part of public safety, and he is currently prepping dozens of elderly victims for a three-week securities fraud trial coming up in the next weeks. He could not put his needs or the needs of his union or anything that he believed in over their needs to be prepped today and to have his assistance. And that's what I'm talking about. I have great respect for my managers. There is absolutely no way if we walked that they could even cover a quarter of our cases. In child advocacy alone, as I stated, we appear in all 36 counties every day. I am in court at least 3 days a week. We are not fungible. We are not desk attorneys. We are needed. We are a vital part of the system. I ask you to support this and make us strike prohibited. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Our next panel includes Donna, I believe it's Barrett.
Bennett.
And then Craig Cavern.
Cowan.
All right. Need a better pen out there to write. Thank you very much. Who'd ever like to go first? Please give us your name.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Craig Cowan. I'm a labor negotiator for the Department of Administrative Services Labor Relations Unit. I am the chief management spokesperson for the state in bargaining with AFSCME, attorneys in DOJ. On January 3, 2013, the union submitted a proposal for binding interest arbitration in negotiations. Since that time, we've had bargaining sessions, we've argued, we have whined at each other, we have talked to each other, been very direct and blunt with each other. The issue is still on top of the table. It has not been withdrawn by the union. We are not withdrawing or refusing to talk. We are still talking about the bargaining, about the issue of interest arbitration. Any kind of bargaining situation, there is no guarantees of end results, but we are still bargaining in good faith and have been since January 3 on this particular issue.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Donna Sandoval Bennett. I am the Human Resource Director for the Department of Justice. I am a previous senior assistant attorney general as well. I only echo what Mr. Cowan has said, and that is that binding arbitration is still on the table. That has never been taken off the table. We have continued to negotiate on issues that are of mutual importance, and we are making some positive strides, I believe. The other issue here is whether the attorney should be allowed to strike or not. There are some compelling statements that have been made with regard to the work that the attorneys do. We're not questioning that. But to compare them with a police officer or a firefighter is, I think, an inaccurate comparison. The attorneys certainly do deal with issues of public safety, but they do it in the realm of administrative law. They do not have the emergency needs that a policeman has of taking care of an immediate danger. For licenses to be revoked, for parental rights to be revoked, that is an administrative process that goes through many steps before there is a final outcome. Unlike a police officer who has to put down a criminal immediately, a firefighter who has to go out and put out a fire, or district attorneys who have to deal with speedy trials. To put the attorneys in that group, is, we believe, is inaccurate and puts them into a group where comparisons are not consistent. The last thing that I would like to say is that the Attorney General has had no opportunity to negotiate with OWASHA previously. She is doing that through the bargaining this go-round, this session, and wants to have that opportunity to continue to bargain over the issues that are of mutual importance. And we ask that this committee, that the legislature not intercede in that and put into place a statute regarding an issue that is on the bargaining table, to let the collective process of negotiations continue and to honor the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? All right, I've got some. So, Ms. Bennett, you made some statements here. I guess I want to clarify for myself at least. I heard testimony previously that deputy district attorneys are, in fact, strike forbidden. Is that correct?
They are strike forbidden, yes, sir.
And doesn't the Department of Justice have a criminal section that actually does the exact same work, that they actually will go out to counties and actually prosecute the same type of cases in place of a deputy district attorney or the district attorney?
Chair, that is true, and that is a relatively small amount of attorneys. We have approximately 300 attorneys within the Department of Justice, and those attorneys that would go out and do that would be a relatively small amount. I'm speculating probably about 20 attorneys. And again, that is not an everyday occurrence.
Mutual importance. I heard you, both of you, use the term mutual importance. Mm-hmm. I want to know whether or not collective bargaining, under the collective bargaining as regarding a no strike clause and mandatory binding arbitration, is that a mutual importance for the state?
There's certainly mutual topics that we are discussing at the negotiating table. Does that answer your question, Chair?
I want to know whether or not it's something that's actually really on the table. I understand it's on the table, but I also am concerned because I believe this issue has been on the table many years over previous negotiations. This isn't the first time, from my understanding, in my days and years here, that this has been a topic for us to consider.
Chair Pozanski, I'll let Craig Cowan answer that. This is my first time in the bargaining and negotiations.
Thank you.
And Chair Pozanski, I started this assignment in 2007, and the last time we bargained, the 11-13 was the first time I saw the interest arbitration issue raised. I cannot speak for what happened prior to 2007, though.
All right. Yes. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2449? Not seeing anyone, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing, and this one we're going to set aside for a little bit as well. All right, so at this point, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2536A. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Work session on House Bill 2536. This is the structured settlement bill. We got an A9 amendment, and we just got it this morning. And I can describe the A9 amendment, and I will point out to the committee there is not really a typo, but something that probably shouldn't have been changed in the A9 amendment. And I'm wondering if we want to take a recess on this bill to correct that, or not sure how we want to do that.
Why don't we do this? Well, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session right now. I forgot that we did have that issue that you raised my attention on 2536A. We're going to come back to that. I do want to talk to the some of the interested parties before we move forward on that. I apologize. And what I think I need to do is I saw that I did not conduct the public hearing on House Bill 2607A. So at this point, I am going to open up that public hearing on 2607A. And
that is Mr. Taylor's.
And that's, I know that's bills. So this is a bill that deals with modifying methods for determining the amount of pre-sentencing incarceration credits for persons convicted of a crime. I have three people that have signed up to give testimony today. I want to give them that opportunity. So I'm going to go ahead and ask Rob Movette, Doug Harcourt, and Cindy Booth to come forward, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Rob.
Mr. Hawker-Road is in another committee at the moment, so I'm trying to cover from both of us, and then
okay.
I would defer if you want to go first. Or
Cindy.
Senator Prozanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Booth. I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to speak briefly on House Bill 2607A. The department appreciates the collaboration of committee counsel, interested legislators, representatives from Legislative Council, and our partners in Judiciary and Justice to identify ways to broaden the application of credit for time served in order to best meet Oregon's needs and interests. Some of the things that we're looking for legislation to accomplish is to broaden the application for time served credits to do the right thing, to ensure more efficient use of DOC beds, and to ensure persons serve no less than the sentence ordered by the court. We believe more work may need to be done, but we stand ready to implement and evaluate the results. Thank you.
Thank you. Rob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I'll be more blunt. 2607A is a bad bill, and we're strongly opposed to it. 2607 itself was probably a good bill. I understand what we wanted to fix there. But when we saw 2607A, we sent it out to our smart people. They don't exactly know what it means. They think it potentially can do some bad things when it comes to defining what is a criminal episode and giving people credit for that, which they really aren't entitled to. And then we don't have a real clear definition of that term except in a separate series of statutes, which compounds the problem. So we had our smart folks talk to the smart folks at DOJ, and they don't even know what it means. So we think 2607A is not yet fully baked. We would ask that you not pass it and create what we believe will be unintended consequences.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2607A. And let's go ahead and drop down. We'll do the work session on 2562A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2562A, the original bill was the bill that updated the electronic court processes. It was the Oregon Judicial Department bill. It had the unfortunate fate to have the relating to courts, relating to clause, so it also got gotten stuffed with the A8 amendment, which is what 2857 used to be. We have amended it slightly from that, and we have Patrick Singh and Carl Myers to talk about the amendments, but basically they reduce the amount that municipal and justice courts send back to the state for the criminal fine account from $60 to $44, establishes parity with the state on amounts after $44, directs payment on the last $16 to the county treasurer, and is effective July 31st, 2013. There's also language that that eliminates the conflicts with another bill about electronic signatures. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. What I'm going to do is ask for Carl Myers and for Patrick Singh to please come forward as they're coming up. This is a work group that the chair participated in at some level. This is one where, if you remember, the state took a position, I believe it was 4 years ago, may have been only 2 years ago, where we basically were requiring under 2712 and 2710 certain type of payments that were going to go to the state, and there's a requirement of $60, the first $60 going to the state before the minor courts, meaning like the JP courts or the municipal courts, would be able to have any money that was collected on a fine going to their entity. That has caused a lot of concern within the different governmental entities that have those courts as to not having any type of parity and ability to actually have equity, and how they were being required to collect the first 60 before they could even be able to pay for any of their expenses. And because of that, I've asked for a group to sit down. We've had numerous meetings, and we've had LFO involved in this meeting, in those meetings as well. And I will tell you that we will be asking for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill, so we've got a light, meaning that it can go through without having the fiscal or the revenue impacts. But I wanted to go ahead and get a few things on the record so everyone knows what we're doing, why we're doing it, and then we'll hopefully send it down to Ways and Means for them to do the number crunching. Gentlemen?
All right, Senator Rowland. Yeah, this was the Nancy Nathanson bill, is it not, that she had worked on for a number of years to kind of expedite the whole court things and get all the fees lined up. And I think the conversation was that this, they weren't sure exactly how this one was going to work. And I think this is a good, anyways.
Yeah. Representative Nathanson was part of this. This one that actually dates back before that. We had the court,
right,
which I was part of.
Yeah.
And so we've worked through this, and that's where I got confused as to when this actually went into effect. This was the most recent rewrite or version of it, and it was one that I believe was pushed through very quickly without full impact considered. Gentlemen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Singh with the Association of Oregon Counties. And, Mr. Chair, I believe you stated the summary of the history of where we got today pretty accurate, but I'll state House Bill 2712 from 2 years ago was kind of a product of a number of years of work relating to court assessments and traffic fines and all of that, and it really did have good intentions, I think. It was kind of meant to streamline all of these court fees and fines, and then also give judges more discretion in some of the work that they do. And also it was meant to be revenue neutral for local governments and local courts as well, too. However, the bill did have a lot of unintended consequences, which included some of the things we're trying to fix today. 2712 adjusted, I think, over 100 statutes. So it was a very large bill. Many of our local courts and subsequently cities and counties are struggling because of many of the changes that happened in that particular bill. We have addressed some of those unintended consequences this session. House Bill 2837, which you all passed and was signed by the governor, helped adjust some of the money that went back to counties for alcohol and drug programs, as well as adult and juvenile corrections. That was just a miscalculation that was in the bill that 2712 didn't have language to. So we fixed that, and that sent a little over $3 million back to counties for those programs. There was also a provision in the bill that we're working to fix through another vehicle regarding liquor enforcement. This was money that was sent to counties from circuit courts for money that was or cases that were prosecuted under the Liquor Control Act. These are minor in possession and other alcohol-related crimes or in violations. About $1 million to counties over a biennium that district attorneys used for deputy DA funding, as well as training and equipment. So we're working to fix that as well. What our Dash A8 amendments do is as the chair mentioned, product of a work group, essentially reverts some things back to pre-2712, where we have a county assessment that's assessed at the justice and municipal court level. Essentially, the amount that 2712 established of $60 is pretty much there, but we're dividing it between $44 that goes to the state from these local courts. That would be $37 to the unitary assessment, $2 to the law enforcement medical liability account, and $5 to the state court facilities account. Those are paid at the front end of the ticket, so the first $44 of every traffic ticket will continue to come to the state and be allocated for those purposes. Then, as Council Braun mentioned, the amount between that first $44 and the last $16 of the fine, when the fines paid fully, is split between the local jurisdiction and then whichever officer cites into that local court. So let's say if a state officer cites, a state trooper cites into a justice court, and that happens a lot in our rural areas, that fine is split between the county and the state. And then the last $16 is reestablishing this county assessment. That money goes to the county. 60% of that is earmarked for alcohol and drug programs, as well as adult and juvenile corrections, and 40% to local court security. These are dedicated funds that our sheriff's offices and our community corrections folks and alcohol and drug programs within our county governments have become very reliant on in terms of their funding.
All right, Patrick, I want to ask you to finish up, because we got 7 minutes. We got three more bills I need to take
care
of.
I believe that summarizes what we're trying to do with the bill, and I'll let Judge Myers add anything that I missed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. I will not need to add much to what Mr. Singh said, other than this bill is terribly important. Prior to 2712, there was a priority payment of $37 that went off the first $37 collected in any traffic violation judgment. They sent that off to the state. 2712 increased that to $60. You can imagine the impact that would have, particularly on judgments that are only partially collected. If we collected $60 before, we only paid $37. If we collected only $60 on a judgment afterwards, the total $60 went. We have not really changed the amount of the $60. It is still there. Only 44 of it is a priority. The last 16 is in the end of the priority, so that at least the local courts get some money back for the prosecution of those cases. This bill is terribly needed to keep those local courts alive financially and to be able to work their end of the public safety system. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I just did about the revenue, and I know that we don't have a revenue statement on this, but I'm...
It's going to Ways and Means.
I know it's going to Ways and Means, so... They'll just have to reconcile, because I'm assuming that this was not taken into account for the judicial budget, this reduction.
Well, what we're trying to do for the judicial budget, I can't say that. What I can say is LFO was part of the negotiations and discussions with this, so I'm assuming they are looking at a bigger picture than we are with just this one bill. That's all I know.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we received fiscal lights and revenue light hall passes.
Which is what we need.
Basically, right. Yeah. Okay. They're just saying they're going to figure it out when it gets down there.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
Well, Mr. Chair, my question, the underlying bill, there's some grammatical changes. The original bill, which I like, we're adding this to it. The changes we made in the original bill are not majorly substantive.
The original bill has not been changed except for that conflict amendment that I mentioned.
There were some grammatical errors.
They will catch that through their proof.
Are you referring to something else on the original bill?
There are changes made on page 2, lines 20 through 22 and 26 through 30. That's what I was referring to. which is what, it's the added language
in
the original bill, and it has been changed. I was just questioning that change.
That change has been reviewed by all interested parties and approved.
Okay, that was my only question.
Okay,
so
all right. So
excuse me, Mr. Chair, just one more thing. There is we did find an error in the bill and that needs to be policed up, and that will be done in Ways and Means. I understand we've talked to Legislative Council and Committee Council about that. It was an oversight in the Dash 8 amendments that we'll police up elsewhere.
All right. Chair moves the Dash 8 into House Bill 2562A. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2562A as amended to, I guess it's to Ways and Means.
Which do pass.
Yeah, Ways and Means. Do we need to suspend the...
No.
We don't need to suspend
the
rules.
No, we don't
okay.
need to suspend the rules.
To... Ways and Means.
Can you request a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Okay. To the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the
and
Ways and Means Committee. A request for the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means
which
Committee.
Which we've already requested. But
we'll stay on that one. Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Senator Cruz, for the coaching.
I think we got this here.
Yeah,
let's figure it out. Senator Dinkfelder moves House Bill 2562A as amended by the A5s with a due pass A8s. To the floor with a due pass recommendation, but request a subsequent referral be attached to send the bill to Ways and Means.
Perfect.
Any discussion?
That was close.
It was real close. Any objection? So ordered. All right. So that takes care of that one. Now what I want to do is, Anna, we have House Bill 2668.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2668, we heard on May 9th. This one expands the definition of public accommodation to places that are open to the public. We have a Dash 3 amendment. The Dash 3 amendment excludes the Department of Corrections, State Hospital Youth Correction Facility, Local Correction Facility, and Institution, Bonafide Club, or Place of Accommodation that is distinctly private. It includes conflict amendments that resolve the conflicts between this bill and Senate Bill 610.
Yes.
We have a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, and this one's ready to move.
Senator Dinkfelder, A3s.
Dash 3s. Mr. Chair, we'll move the Dash 3s into House Bill 2668.
Senator
or be adopted, yes.
Senator Dinkfelder moves for the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2668. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2668 as amended with the Dash 3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Dinkfelder moves House Bill 2668 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Frederick for his work on this. I did not see the need as far as I understand that there were concerns about for the amendment. I didn't really think that there were issues that were raised, but I'm fine with it and would request to carry it to the floor.
All right, Mr. Chair, I just point out, Senator Dinkfelder, if we hadn't passed 610, there wouldn't have been a need, but because of that,
okay.
So
yeah.
it just makes the universe a kinder place,
right? And it puts in, I guess, statute what we believe has already been determined by the court, and
for
so
the private.
Is clarification, yes, of
okay.
accommodations.
Yep.
So with that, any objection to the motion? Not hearing or seeing any, it is so ordered. And Senator Dinkfelder, you will be our carrier on House Bill 2668 as amended by the Dash 3s. We'll close the work session. And then I want to come back and open the work session on House Bill 2536A. And Mr. Romaine, Paul, why don't you come up for a moment? Sorry.
Do you like me to explain the A9's amendments?
If you
just
would do
briefly.
So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 2536 is the structured settlement bill. We have an A9 amendment, substantially rewrites the bill. It requires a payee to declare under oath in a petition to the court whether the payee depends on structured settlement funds for household expenses, relies on government assistance, or needs funds for medical expenses related to the structured settlement. If so, it requires two quotes in the petition and as requirement of a written finding by the judge that is in the payee's best interest to sell the structured settlement. It removes the personal information from the petition, defines independent professional advice, requires petition and disclosure notices to be sent 14 days before the hearing, states that payee signs transfer agreement at the hearing, and allows 3 days after the hearing to cancel the agreement.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
All right, Paul, I understand you brought to our attention the typo that wasn't caught by us when we were going through the final drafting on this amendment. So I'd just like to make certain we put everything on the record as to where we're at and what we're planning on doing, so everyone understands that we expect this to move forward with the understanding that there is at least one change that needs to be made, and that Representative Hovey was supposed to have the opportunity to do a not consent to the changes that we make, and be able to have a conference committee. And it looks at this point we're going to need to do that if we're going to make this change or not.
Well, we could pass it today and then intend to have the conference committee make the change there, or we could wait and pass it with the change today.
All right. So if we can actually get the amendment done?
We could get the I believe it's just changing of 14 to 20 days. 20.
All right. Why don't we just do this, because we are going to be recessing because we have these other bills. And Mr. Romaine, unless you have an issue with that, I think it would be cleaner to do it that way.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine representing the settlement purchasers. And we would actually, if you can clean it up, that would be better. The best. It's simply a Scrivener.
It's actually, you didn't mean to change the current law. We were working off the amendments, and in the flurry of paper, none of us caught that we had changed the current law. Nobody meant to do that.
14 days on steroids.
So it's supposed to be 20 days, when now it's 14 days.
Scrivener, or is it substantive?
No, it's not a Scrivener. It's
substantive,
it needs
unfortunately,
process.
But so it should take another amendment.
But nobody meant to change it, so.
I don't think we're.
I guess we'd be more comfortable.
Conceptual amendments.
Well, yeah,
exactly.
I was thinking that. I was there, but I don't think we're going
to
go there.
One of the issues, if for some reason it doesn't go to a conference committee, if there is, then you have this kind of inconsistency. Frankly, from our position, that's fine, but from the other side, they may not like that, so we think they might want to.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and recess our committee. What we're doing, we're going to recess till this afternoon at 4:45.
Are you doing something here?
We have three of the members on this committee that are on a committee that starts at 3, and the good chair of that committee has a pretty good workload for us, and so we're going to see if we can be here at 4:45. It's possible that we will not be able to get out until 5 o'clock. The chair does have a meeting that I cannot get out of if it actually still goes forward, so that would mean we'd be here at 5:15. But we're going to go for 4:45 at this point.
Yeah.
Can we talk about what's being carried over, please?
Well, we're just recessing. Everything that's on the agenda is there. What we have not taken action on are the three bills that are under the public hearing and possible work session, and also the first of the work session bills. I believe we've taken care of all the other bills.
And 668. Is that the one? Oh, we did that one.
We did that.
Dingfelder has that one. The one before it went to Ways and Means. Cruz and Przonski has 2710. And we've taken care of, you got the one on the bottom, and I have the one on the page 2.
Yep.
Okay, so we're looking at four bills.
Pretty much that's where we're at.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if I might ask, so you're going to get an A-10 amendment to the bill that will take care of the issue that we were talking about.
That's my understanding.
Will you be in need of any testimony at 4:45, 5 o'clock, or 5:15?
Someone must be having other plans.
Well, no, I'm just wondering how
secure
my marriage
is. I do not need to be here.
Point.
I think with your presence this morning,
thank you.
You can be excused this afternoon.
Thank you.
Unless Senator Cruz thinks for some reason he wants you here.
I could be mean, but I'll be nice today on that.
All right. We'll be in this room.
We will be in this room. So we're recessing until this afternoon at 4:45. Thank you for all that are here. And I will be meeting with some of the individuals involved in these other bills that are still lingering in our committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.